Governor Doug Ducey's proposed budget for the next fiscal year restores some of the funding universities have lost recently. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Arizona Board of Regents President Eileen Klein about what she thinks of the proposal, which still leaves ASU, NAU, and the U of A well short of their previous funding levels. Also, Arizona has made strides recently when it comes to juvenile justice, but some are concerned the new state policies could raise obstacles. I'll talk with Bill Hart, author of a recent Morrison Institute report on that topic. Plus, SMOCA is hosting a new exhibition of the art of Betty Saar. It's the 89-year-old's first solo show in an American museum in 5 years. I'll talk with Saar about the exhibition called Still Tickin'. And Seinfeld star Jason Alexander is coming to the Valley this week. I'll find out why he loves live performances and how he'd feel about a lead role in a TV drama. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, Arizona has made strides recently when it comes to juvenile justice, but some are concerned that new state policies could raise obstacles. I'll talk with Bill Hart, author of a recent Morrison Institute report called Juvenile Justice in Arizona, The Fiscal Foundations of Effective Policy. Also, SMOCA is hosting a new exhibition on the art of Betty Saar. It's the 89-year-old's first solo show in an American museum in 5 years. I'll talk with Saar about the exhibition, which is called Still Tickin'. And Seinfeld star Jason Alexander is coming to the Valley this week. I'll find out why he loves live performances and how he'd feel about a lead role in a TV drama. We start today's program with a closer look at Governor Doug Ducey's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. Over the course of nearly a decade, the state's universities saw nearly $500 million in cuts, and during the last legislative session, $99 million were sliced. This month's proposal turns university funding back in a positive direction, but not by much. Joining me to talk about that and a couple of other state university issues is Eileen Klein, president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Eileen, good morning.
Good morning.
So you testified before the Senate Appropriations Committee yesterday, and you were treated to an exchange with Senator John Kavanaugh, as many of us have been. What was the biggest area of disagreement there?
Well, I think the real challenge is just how universities are going to be funded going forward. As was made clear yesterday, the university presidents and I, on the authorization of the board, are recommending a change in funding direction, not just in terms of dollars, but how the universities are funded to help improve affordability for Arizona families. We'd like to get back on track where the universities are being funded every year consistently. Governor Ducey asked for a sustainable funding model from us last spring. We've delivered on that, and we believe that all the dollars going forward should be directed so that we can help students offset the cost of their tuition.
There is an issue there that it feels like in-state students are taking a lot of this burden. Is that how you feel?
Absolutely. And today, the state is only covering about 34% of the cost of a resident student's education. That simply doesn't work in the long run. And our students have pretty great financial need. So what we're eager to do is really change the funding relationship and make sure that state appropriations going forward are directed first and foremost to students to help them afford their college experience.
How long-term a project is that? Can that be done in the short term?
Well, it will take a couple of years to get to a 50-50 relationship. We're asking the state to cover approximately half of the costs. We're doing our part to make sure those costs are being held as low as possible. Today, our costs are actually below where they were in 2010 due to a lot of work on cost effectiveness and efficiency. But ultimately, we need the state to be sure to pay their fair share. And rather than having general fund dollars flow in for general purposes or having state taxpayer dollars subsidize students no matter where they come from, we'd like to see those dollars directed behind our students, and our students have spoken up and said they'd like to see that too.
Eileen, you've been in this job long enough, and of course you've been in the realm of politics before. Where does that disconnect come from when it comes to certain lawmakers and certain areas of government as it relates to university funding? I mean, we all understand the recession and what that did, but we're out of the recession, and it seems like the tide has not turned as much as many people think it should.
Well, it's important to make the case for lawmakers that economic recovery is going to be accelerated by creating more highly educated individuals in the state. Today, the university system is the majority producer of individuals with advanced degrees. We know that most of the jobs of the future are going to require post-secondary education, and we've been trying to work with policymakers to make that connection. But they are rightfully concerned about the relative value of a college degree, and we're working very hard to make sure we have all the performance measures in place and the metrics to really show how we're delivering that value for Arizona families. So I welcome the conversation and welcome the debate, but it can't distract us from what absolutely has to be done, which is fund our students and our universities.
Well, let's go to what Governor Ducey had to say. After years of deep cuts, as I mentioned, Governor Ducey's proposed budget adds at least a little bit of funding. It's not much, but how do you interpret that?
Well, Governor Ducey made a pledge to partner with the university system. That's very significant. Not every governor in every state does that. Governor Ducey clearly recognizes the value that universities deliver, not just to individuals and their opportunities, but really to the state's economy. So it was very significant to see him endorsing this new student-centered funding model and to put new dollars behind the formula. So it's very clear that's a first step, but we want to make sure that we're working to garner as many dollars as possible this year. But having the governor standing firmly behind this direction for the university system is incredibly important.
Eileen, I talked with Bill Harris of Science Foundation Arizona last week, and coming back to what you were talking about with economic development, I mean, not surprisingly, he supports additional funding for the universities, especially turning university research into an economic development tool, monetizing that research. I know it's not a new concept, but it does seem like Arizona is behind when it comes to that, even though it seems like the major universities are doing some pretty important research. Again, are we talking about a dichotomy there, a misunderstanding of what the universities can and should be doing, or from the legislative standpoint?
Well, today, the university research portfolio is over $1 billion, and we want to be sure we can double that capacity over the course of the next 10 years in terms of the dollars that we're attracting to the state. And that is an important part for propelling business and new business ventures and spinoffs. We've had numerous businesses started from university research, and we are doing more to commercialize. In other words, make sure that we take those ideas and inventions and put them out in the marketplace as quickly as possible. But really, for the lawmakers, one of the reasons we wanted to change the funding model is to make sure that lawmakers are funding the most important priorities, which is supporting individuals in the state. And while the research functions incredibly important and makes us public, you know, the public institutions that we are and of world renown, we really feel like in an era of limited resources, we first have to direct those dollars to make sure that we're keeping the costs down for students so that they have the opportunities that they need. So we're going to continue to work in the medium and long range on improving our research portfolio and trying to attract new dollars, and particularly in the infrastructure that we need in buildings and other dollars that we need to attract the top research talent. But our first job has to be in improving affordability for our residents.
I still want to follow up, though, on the R&D situation, which is, do you think the state should make a commitment to research and development at the universities and in the university's role in that, even in recessionary periods? Can there be some money put aside to say, this is for universities, especially as it relates to research and development, which can be monetized?
Well, you know, certainly we want to see the state maintain as many priorities as possible. But during a downturn, and you know, I've had to work on a lot of state budgets during the downturn, I think it's unrealistic to expect that in a time when people are being removed from cash assistance or health care programs, potentially life-saving health care programs, that university research is going to take a top priority with the legislature. I don't know that we should ask our lawmakers to do that. Instead, what we need to do is try to figure out what some sustainable paths are, what the funding streams are that we need, and how do we create a long-term plan so that overall we have more highly educated individuals who are less dependent on the state, and we have the ongoing support so that overall not just the universities but the people of the state can withstand economic cycles. To me, it's coming up with that policy set that's really important in the long term.
Well, it certainly seems like you have a lot of ideas for that and you're putting a lot of energy into this. My last question for you, though, is it seems to me that based on the experience you've had, you are, and as president of the Board of Regents, you are out there quite often. You are out there representing the Regents. You are testifying before appropriations committees, for example. Does the public need to hear more from the Regents, the actual Board of Regents members, to feel like this is going in the right direction? Or can you represent their points of view?
Well, I really like to believe that I'm not representing the Regents. I and the Regents are representing the public. So while I'm their full-time president, the reality is that we're all here in place on behalf of the public to make sure that we are delivering as much value as we can to them on behalf of the public university system. So while I might be the most quoted person, really I'm trying to reflect the viewpoints of the board. And remember, these are public members. These are lay members of the board, and they come from all walks of life in Arizona, and they're there really to safeguard both the promise that's made in the Constitution to the people, and also to deliver on the responsibilities that the people have given to us around public higher education. And so we take that job very seriously, and we have to have a business mindset to do that. So the regents are completely committed to all of the plans. They're looking to have even greater performance come out of this system and holding their presidents to high account. And they are completely unified in their support of the public university system and a more affordable college experience for Arizonans.
Eileen Klein is president of the Arizona Board of Regents. Eileen, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona has made strides recently when it comes to juvenile justice, but some are concerned the new state policies could raise obstacles. Those include a measure passed during the last legislative session, SB 1478. A new report has just been completed by Bill Hart of the Morrison Institute at ASU. The report is called Juvenile Justice in Arizona, the Fiscal Foundations of Effective Policy. And Bill Hart joins me now. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Steve.
So based on the research you've done, why is locking up juvenile offenders not an especially effective method and actually could create more problems?
It's not so much the research. Excuse me, my voice is not what it should be. It's not so much my research, although it's secondary research. There's been research all across the country that indicates several important points about juvenile incarceration. Nobody denies that there always will be a small percentage of juveniles who do need to be locked up for public safety. But over the years, there's a general consensus now that we've been using incarceration much too often for juvenile offenders. And the number of research studies, including some conducted here in Maricopa County, have shown that incarceration not only doesn't help or stop crime on the part of youth, but it can, in some cases, increase it. It also creates a negative environment for them. And for those high percentage of juveniles who enter the system who are mentally ill, it only makes matters worse. It does not cut down on recidivism and has serious and can have serious long-term emotional effects on the children.
So, Bill, has the momentum then come from the additional research, or has part of that come from people just, frankly, being more enlightened, paying more attention to the research?
I think it's the research. It's also the fact that we have sort of some breathing room because, fortunately, as I'm sure you know, juvenile crime is down significantly in the past 10 years, along with adult crime, as are juvenile arrests in Arizona, juvenile petitions, and those who are going into court and going into the Adobe Mountain confinement facility. So I think that more and more people are realizing that we can take this opportunity to use more evidence-based approaches in dealing with youth, which means treating more of them in the community where they can maintain ties with their families and their communities.
Bill, is there a greater impact on juveniles who are non-white who've been confined? Do they face even more problems?
They do, in the sense that they are disproportionately represented in the juvenile justice system. That is higher than their presence in the general population. We're talking about Latinos, African Americans, and Native Americans in particular. And they have been, studies have shown, including studies done by Nancy Rodriguez here at ASU, that they suffer discrimination. Children of color suffer discrimination at multiple points in the criminal justice system, including referrals, dispositions, and whether or not they're sent to be locked up.
That's Bill Hart of the Morrison Institute at ASU. He's written a report called Juvenile Justice in Arizona, the Fiscal Foundations of Effective Policy. Bill will stay with us. We'll also be joined by Beth Rosenberg of Children's Action Alliance coming up. Stay tuned to Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting an evening of music and humor with Tony Award-winning Jason Alexander, known for his role as George Costanza on Seinfeld, January 30th and 31st, phoenixsymphony.org.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Stay with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Taking a look at the Valley Freeways right now, Loop 101 northbound, there's a collision on the Bell Road exit ramp. Well, mostly sunny skies around the state right now. It's 59 degrees in Tucson, 61 in Casa Grande, 48 degrees right now in Prescott, and 39 in Flagstaff. Public media sponsorships generate results. Connect with smart listeners who support their city and their public radio station. For more information on how to be an even more remarkable business supporter, go to corporatesupport.kjzz.org. Right now in Phoenix, mostly sunny skies and 61 degrees at 11:21.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're talking about juvenile justice in Arizona and a new report just completed by Bill Hart of the Morrison Institute. I also wanted to tell you about an event taking place tomorrow morning at 8:30 at the Burton Barr Library, the Pulliam Auditorium. We'll be talking about Bill's report, Juvenile Justice in Arizona, The Fiscal Foundations of Effective Policy. And also joining us now is Beth Rosenberg, Director of Child Welfare and Juvenile Justice at Children's Action Alliance. Beth, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be on the show.
So, Beth, give us an idea. I mentioned in my introduction initially, and Bill wrote about it, what's the potential impact of Senate Bill 1478 in terms of whether limiting confinement for juvenile offenders will still move in that direction?
Well, when the budget passed last session for this fiscal year, it's the first time that the state went to the counties and asked them to support the Arizona Juvenile Corrections Department, and it basically it's Adobe Mountain facility, which is a secure facility for youth. And we were concerned about what the impact of that legislation would be, whether it would encourage any youth to be sent to that Adobe Mountain as opposed to keeping them in the community. And other states have restructured their funding streams for juvenile justice system to encourage community-based programming, and we were concerned this did just the opposite. So we wanted to see what was happening in Arizona and what the funding meant for basically going through the best practices, which is what Bill referred to in terms of community-based programming.
I want to have both of you comment on this. Beth, let me start with you first. If it's been proven that confinement is a negative way, it's not the direction to go for a high percentage of juvenile offenders, where does punishment fit in? We obviously don't want to wreck people's lives at a young age, but what is the proper way to punish those who've done wrong without taking away their direction for a good future?
Well, I think that many of those youth still, if they're adjudicated delinquent, they can be put on probation. There is intensive probation, and there are programming within the community that some people might refer to as punishment. And I think what we really want to do is turn those lives around so youth can be more positive in terms of their future outcomes, and it's better for public safety as well. So we know that youth can do much better in community-based programs that deal with their issues and work with their families.
Bill, are there other states that are doing similar things?
Yes, there are. And as Beth said, punishment does enter into it because there are confinements, there are restrictions on probation for these youth, there are fines and restitutions that may come into play. So there are punishments other than incarceration. And in general, while punishment is classically seen as one of the generally accepted functions of imprisonment for adults, I think we have to recognize that the traditionally juvenile courts in the juvenile justice system are more of an effort to recognize that children and their emotional development and all are not like adults, something, by the way, that the Supreme Court of the United States seems to be recognizing more and more, and that the approach should not be one so much of punishment as treatment and rehabilitation.
I'm struck by the fact we seem to be hearing a lot at the national level, and even a little bit in Arizona as well, about criminal justice reform when it comes to adults, and it does seem like we're hearing that from both the right and the left. Beth, are we seeing the same sort of discussion when it comes to juvenile justice, or are there still more obstacles to that than there would be for adults?
Well, I think certainly the courts have worked very well with in all the different counties in terms of looking at what's the best treatment options for youth in the system. I think they have worked. There's an Annie Casey Foundation initiative called the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative that are really looking at reducing the number of youth who are detained in secure facilities within the county. So there's lots of effort in the state at the local level and at the state court level to do what's best for the community and for the youth. And I think that we've made a lot of progress. There is some progress in the adult system, but clearly the state is building more, you know, prisons, spending money doing that, whereas the Department of Juvenile Corrections, their youth population in the secure facilities has been reduced. So I think we're doing better in the juvenile justice system in Arizona than I would say in the compared to what's going on in the adult system right now.
So what do you think some of Arizona's most viable options are as far as evolving when it relates to juvenile justice? Are there some things that have not yet been done that would make a lot of sense coming up in the short term?
Well, I think one of the reasons we asked Morrison Institute to do this study is to take a look at what's going on in other states. And we do think there is a opportunity to look at the fiscal structure and how we're supporting courts and the treatment options that are in the community that we know are better for kids. And so we hope that this report and the discussion we'll have tomorrow will further stimulate people to look at the issue and try to strategize what steps need to be made to move forward.
And Bill, just about a minute left. I want to make sure I get this question in because we talk about how different states do things, whether it's allocation of funding or some of the policies they have. What do juvenile offenders have in common? I guess, are there certain things that many of them just in fact haven't come, regardless of what state? Did you find any of that in some of the research you did?
I didn't specifically research the backgrounds of children involved in the system in other states. However, you can say that they are disproportionately minority, and they are often disproportionately come from lower income families and troubled, shall we say, backgrounds. In fact, something like a high percentage of them suffer from some form of mental illness. In fact, the Adobe Mountain here in Arizona statistics show that about a third of the people confined there, the children, are seriously mentally ill.
Gosh.
And so these things are quite common across a lot of states. And they include children who have witnessed trauma of various sorts in their lives that are still coping or trying to cope with the aftermath of that, all of which points towards the idea that we should take a treatment approach than a punishment approach.
That's Bill Hart of the Morrison Institute at ASU. His new report is called Juvenile Justice in Arizona, the Fiscal Foundations of Effective Policy. We've also been joined by Beth Rosenberg, Director of Child Welfare and Juvenile Justice at Children's Action Alliance. They'll both be at the event tomorrow morning at 8:30 at the Burton Barr Library discussing Bill's report. Thanks very much to you both.
Okay,
thank you.
Steve.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio has been especially busy lately, facing a civil trial and his agency ignoring a federal judge's orders, among other things. He's also raising money for a re-election run. And last night he was with Donald Trump, endorsing the Republicans' presidential candidacy. But the sheriff came to prominence a couple of decades ago for items that seemed more focused on publicity that would attract TV, radio, and newspaper reporters. Those included pink underwear and green bologna and much more. The sheriff's media guru for his time in office has been Lisa Allen. She's retiring as of next week, so we wanted to ask Allen about her work with Arpaio. Lisa, first of all, let's start with some of the better-known promotions that the sheriff's office has had and some of the ones with lighter touches, let's say, like pink underwear and green bologna. How many of those are you responsible for?
Well, I'm not responsible really for the pink underwear. That came to him completely out of left field from somebody in the laundry room who reported that all of these things were being stolen. And maybe we need to do something about it. But as far as my stuff was concerned, the ones that I was most proud of were certainly early on. I was taking a nap one day, and I woke up and I thought, God, we should do a vacancy sign above Tent City. So the vacancy sign was my idea. I thought it was hysterical, and it certainly gave a message to the cops that we're always going to have room to book their bad guys when jails across the country were letting people out right and left.
Now, you and I have both known, obviously, with the business we're in, we've both known a lot of people in communications jobs, PIO positions. So when it comes to listeners, what they know about things may be different, but being the media person for a larger-than-life official like the sheriff can lead to sacrificing your own viewpoints, your own standards, in some cases, even if you personally like the person. So what was the hardest part of disagreeing with some of what the sheriff wanted to do, and yet you still had to be in charge of public relations for him?
Right. Well, let me start by answering that question this way. That is one, I think, absolutely fabulous thing about Arpaio, is that he allows people to disagree with him on issues. He'll listen to him. He'll argue till the cows come home. But he listens because eventually, a few days later, you might be able to change his mind. And, of course, oh, it was always his idea. But I think he's obviously the boss. You have to keep that in mind. But he and I both know that where we certainly departed company, and I've been public about it, is on that birth certificate thing. I didn't get it. I still don't get it. I don't understand why it's important to him that, you know, we determine whether or not that document was fraudulent.
With President Obama, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Obama's out of office soon. I don't get what difference it makes. But it was important to him, and so I had to write about it. I had to open up a press conference on it, and I felt kind of embarrassed personally. But, hey, I mean, he's the boss, so you do what you got to do.
Well, it reminds me of a book a few years ago called Thank You for Smoking, where you had the main character in the book was a guy who represented the tobacco companies. It is a job, and even if you disagree sometimes, ultimately you have to do it. Did you feel extra pressure, though, from outside sources to say, come on, Lisa, you've got to, you know, I know he's your boss, but you got to stick up. I mean, did you ever feel that way?
No. I mean, I wouldn't let an outside source influence me one way or the other. I mean, I've got my own. I'm a very strong person and a very opinionated person, and they're not going to really influence me. I'll just take a look at it myself. But I wouldn't say that I got influenced by anybody else.
Okay. One thing that always struck me is this idea that, and I'm sure a lot of this was you, some of this was just the sheriff and the personality he had, but media members would always come running to go to his press conferences or his news conferences. And I would say even sometimes when the stories didn't seem that important, what makes the sheriff stand out like that? I mean, is it partly because in law enforcement, because of the promotions that the agency would do? Is part of it the fact, did this ever happen where he would hold a grudge against people who didn't come?
Well, here's how I think, how it was kind of a beautiful marriage, if you will. You know, from the 23 years we were together, for the first maybe 15 or so, you're right. The media would come to us right and left on everything that we did. And I think it was because, excuse me, I think it was because being from television, I didn't care too much about radio. I didn't care too much even about what print did, because I don't think that people really get much of their news or seriously strong impressions of a person through those two mediums, because television is both audio and video. It just seems to me like that was the place where you were going to make or break a personality. And so because I came from television and I understood explicitly what this television market needed in a story, and this, I'm not sure that what Joe Arpaio and I did together in Phoenix would have come off as well, say, in a market like Boston, where maybe the journalists are a bit more serious and so forth. But we're kind of, you know, I've always thought that the television market here was very influenced by California. It's a little bit lighter. It's a little bit more fun. It's a little bit more entertainment-oriented. And so everything that we did, although we did it for a purpose, there was a law enforcement or financial purpose or whatever behind it, we tried to make it interesting in a way that television could tell the story. And for the longest time, I think it worked beautifully.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with Lisa Allen. She's been in charge of communications and public information for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office for a couple of decades, and she's retiring next week. Lisa, one thing that stands out for a lot of people, even those who perhaps were not fans of the sheriff, even as he was winning elections by 40 points, will point to the turn on undocumented immigrants and the time when Andrew Thomas was in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. Did you feel like that was a legitimate turn by the sheriff, or was that another PR move?
No, I think that, you know, and of course we still have to be very careful talking about this because, as you know, there's a court,
right, of course.
There's a judge sitting over there in the court deciding what we're going to, what he's going to do with us. But I have always believed this agency is not a racist agency. We didn't go after brown-skinned people. The sheriff believed, and I did not disagree with him, that the key word in illegal immigration was illegal. And somehow or another, the whole thing got turned, I think, by the ACLU and sympathizers and so forth to make it like this agency was really doing something wrong. I don't believe we were. I know that this agency is not a racist law enforcement agency. We just thought that if you come into this country illegally, you've broken a law and it needs to be enforced.
It just seemed like the timing of it was that before that, the sheriff did not seem to have a personal issue. If you ask him his personal viewpoint on that, it didn't seem like it was a top priority for him. So it seemed opportunistic to a lot of people.
It could have. And I honestly don't know what, you know, how the genesis of it was. I don't know if it was somehow or another got onto the national landscape, political landscape, that it was becoming more and more of an issue. I don't think it's anything that he cooked up all on his own, certainly. But I think that, you know, he saw it as a problem. You can certainly see it in our jails. You know, you've got an awful lot of people, undocumented people, getting arrested and rearrested and rearrested. And so it's clear that people in the federal government, ICE and so forth, they don't seem to be doing the job they're supposed to do, which is deporting these people or whatever, because they keep coming back to our jails. And that's costing you and me as a taxpayer a lot of money.
Lisa, I want to make it clear when I ask questions like this that you're not the person who sets policy. For anyone listening right now, you're in charge of public information and communication. So there are some people, though, who've said that some of the promotions, of course, we talked about a few of them, some of which were your idea and some of which were not. The feeling is that the Maricopa County Sheriff is such an important position because it's a law enforcement position. There are some who've been concerned about some of the promotions making, I don't want to say a mockery, but making it seem a little bit silly, whereas in maybe other jobs that would be okay, and this one, it's not. Do you have any strong feelings about that either way?
Well, no. I mean, you really probably have to give me an idea about specifically what you're talking about, one of the things that we've done that might make a mockery of law enforcement. I think that everything that we've done, as I said, has had a meaning behind it. For example, we banned coffee and cigarettes and movies in the jail, all right? And somebody might look at that and go, oh, that's really kind of silly to talk about. But the fact of the matter is that coffee was very expensive and it provided absolutely no nutrition. Obviously, there was a time in our jail system where inmates were able to watch movies like Silence of the Lambs, where cops were killed by bad guys and so on and so forth. That didn't seem to make any sense. Everything that we did, although some of them may seem gimmicky, and that would have been my doing, certainly more than his, still had a law enforcement purpose behind it.
That's Lisa Allen. She's been in charge of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office communications and public affairs and public information for more than a couple of decades, and she's retiring from the job as of next week. Lisa, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, I'll talk with 89-year-old artist Betty Saar. She has a new exhibition at Smoka, and we'll talk to former Seinfeld star Jason Alexander. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, helping to improve air quality with about a third of its energy coming from carbon-free sources and with a growing fleet of electric vehicles and alternative fuel trucks. Learn more at srpcares.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now at 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Valley forecast calling for sunshine and a high near 69 degrees. Very similar conditions for the next couple of days, mostly sunny with highs expected to hover in the low 70s. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on the Loop 101 freeway, we're still seeing a report of an accident on the northbound Bell Road exit. Join us today at noon for NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, 61 degrees at 11:41.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Jason Alexander is best known for playing George Costanza on Seinfeld.
Believe it or not, George isn't at home. Please leave a message at the beep. I must be out before I pick up the phone. Where could I be? Believe it or not, I'm not home.
Alexander will be in the Valley this weekend, singing and doing other performing with the Phoenix Symphony. Andy joins me now. Jason, how does live performance compare for you to being on a TV soundstage?
Most actors, usually find their way into this craziness via some sort of live performing, usually school theater or community theater or something like that. And if that doesn't ring your bell, it's unusual that somebody continues, developing a film or television career. I've always loved live performing. I never really fantasized a career beyond it. I didn't think when I was a young actor that it was going to be film or television for me. I was spending my days focused on theater and mostly theater in New York and a lot of it musical. And I guess it's a combination of two things. One is, we get jazzed by the immediate response of an audience. We love that form of communication. There's something very electrifying and gratifying about it. And I think the other side of it is that if you are someone who has studied the craft of performing, it's a very pure, you're very pure in your craft. It is you and the audience. And even though there has been a director or there's a show around you and there's a lot of collaborators on theater and live performance. But in that time that you're up there, there is no editor, there is nobody scoring you, there's no alternative take. It's you and your technique and your craft, and you are as good as you are. And it's a real barometer of where you are as a live craftsman of the arts. And I find it challenging and exciting, and I think I would, if it were completely removed from my palette as an actor, I probably would find acting far less engaging.
Is there that emotional spark that comes from live? You mentioned the audience, but I even mean before you go out. Let's say you're having a day where you're a little tired out or you're not feeling quite up to snuff. Hearing that vibe in a theater and knowing that you're getting out there live on stage, does that give you that extra burst you sometimes need?
Well, it certainly can. Like, for instance, this summer I was I took over for Larry David in the play that he wrote, Fish in the Dark, on Broadway. So that was back to eight times a week, and it's a hard play, and an eight-time-a-week schedule is a hard schedule. It's wearying. And there are shows later in the week where you're heading out to the theater and your whole being is going, I don't want to do this today. This is going to be hard. And then you get backstage and you start hanging out with your castmate or the people with the crew backstage. And particularly when an audience is excited about what they want to see, as can often happen on Broadway and often happens in a pop concert symphony venue, there's something about their excitement that is like a shot of adrenaline. It revs you up. It makes you excited to do the thing you're going to do. I would imagine it's the same for athletes before they compete. There's something about actually being surrounded by the crowd and the onlookers and the spectators and the competitors, and it's different from training. So there is a thrill to it, and it can be very rejuvenating. I've actually worked from time to time with elderly actors who, they're pretty exhausted. They look a little haggard before they get on the stage, and then the minute they get on that stage, they are vital and alive and full of pep, and they're astonishing. And then they step off the stage, and they're right back to being haggard and old and weary. But we in the biz call it Dr. Footlights, and Dr. Footlights can have extraordinary results a lot of the time.
So folks who see you with the Phoenix Symphony coming up, what are they going to see, Jason? Are they going to see Triple Threat? Are they going to hear you sing? Are they going to see you dance? What's going to happen?
I would say I'm a two and a half threat. the days of my hardcore dancing are probably a little behind me. It's definitely, it takes me back to my roots as a Broadway song and dance man. The material of the show, except for the opening number, is all songs from the theater, musical theater. Some of them very well known, some of them not very well known, and all having to do with my particular journey and connection to theater music. But what I did when we designed the show is I wanted to have more fun than the average symphony hall kind of show does. I didn't want it to be stuffy or stodgy. I wanted it to have both musical and emotional variety. So there's a lot of laughs. There's a lot of stories. I feel like the audience gets to know me a little bit in a way. Some of the music is actually fairly dramatic, and I like breaking conventions. So it's some of it is songs you wouldn't normally think of in a pop concert. I also, in one number, I bring seven people up on the stage, chosen randomly in the audience, and they do the darn thing with me. So that's kind of unusual, too. And it's just a different kind of an evening. But yes, if you're used to seeing me only as George, you will come to the thing and go, where did this come from? And I can tell you, this is what I was doing long before George was even a twinkle in anybody's eye.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We're talking with actor and performer Jason Alexander. He'll be performing with the Phoenix Symphony coming up on Saturday, January 30th and Sunday, January 31st. Was there ever talk, as different as Seinfeld was there ever talk because of your talents and because of some of the talents of your fellow performers of making almost like a musical episode?
Yeah, I think there probably was some talk about it. You know, I'm fairly certain, I wouldn't swear on a stack of Bibles, but I'm pretty certain that Michael does not sing and that Jerry won't sing. So that would leave it down to me and Julia. You know, Larry David loves music and he loves musicals. And we did a fair amount of organic music in a bunch of the episodes. But the knowledge, the idea that any of the people in Seinfeld, the characters, would have any kind of a talent, I think is anathema to the series, so I don't think it would have come off terribly well. There was a lot of it. I mean, you know, as a couple of shows were doing musical episodes, I think there was one notion one time that we would do an episode entirely in claymation, and that somehow, you know, lost its way as well. But I'm actually kind of pleased that we didn't get too crazy, because every episode was a ton of fun, and it didn't really need sort of more hurdles to jump over. I think they all came out the way they should. But if you only know me as a singer, as George the singer, with my bad rendition of Greatest American Hero.
Well,
on my
that's
phone
exactly
machine,
what popped in, yes, right.
Yes, or my, you know, my rendition of Master of the House from Les Mis. It's better than that, I promise.
Sure. And one more question related to that. You did a Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld as George Costanza. Is there a possibility of you doing one as Jason Alexander?
That is a Jerry Seinfeld question. You know, my answer would be, if nominated, I will run. If elected, I will serve. It's totally Jerry's thing. So I don't know. He may feel like he had enough of Jason with George, or he may not. I don't know if I'm the next step up from the President of the United States. So it might be a bit of a back step for him. I'm not sure.
You were on what may be considered the greatest comedy of all time in Seinfeld, but you're also... You have such a deep background, and I wonder, this is considered by many people, based on the options and based on the different channels there are and the different downloads we can do, it's considered to be a golden age of TV drama. Have you been approached? Have you wanted to do something like the equivalent of Mad Men or Breaking Bad or Transparent? Is there a role out there for Jason Alexander, and would you embrace it?
Sure, absolutely. There probably are. It's going to take a very wise producer to explore that possibility, because a lot of them just don't want to deal with the iconic nature of George, and having an audience be reintroduced to me or me as another character. I'd love to do a great drama. I think they're exciting and challenging, and you know, they're working so well. They're such good, as you point out, such good work being done in drama. I've done some dramatic roles in film and television and stage. They have always seemed to go very well. And I would grab one in a second. I also know in the back of my head, and I've made my peace with this actually, that as good as the dramas are, and they are, I think, the mainstay of television right now, the world could use some comedy. And I have great respect for the people that are out there trying to make great comedy. It's actually harder to do than great drama, to lift people out of themselves and their lives and their troubles far enough that they can actually laugh consistently at a show week after week is extremely hard to do. And if I could find the right collaborators to do that with again, I'd be very happy to do that as well. There's an importance to it that I used to poo-poo because it was what I was doing and I didn't want to be self-congratulatory about it. But it is real, and we need it. And so I'm hopeful that one of the two will surface again.
Jason Alexander will be with the Phoenix Symphony at Phoenix Symphony Hall on Saturday, January 30th and Sunday, January 31st. Jason, thank you for the time.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you so much.
And the Phoenix Symphony is a KJZZ underwriter. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Artist Betty Saar has been creating art for more than six decades with big themes that have included nostalgia, mysticism, politics, and race. Now at the age of 89, she'll be presenting her first solo show at an American museum in 5 years. It's opening at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA, later this week, and the exhibition is called Still Tickin', and Betty Saar joins me now. In your opinion, for art to be impactful, does it have to touch on significant issues, whether it's politics or race or aging?
No, because artists can be anything they want and say anything they want, unfortunately, sometimes. But it's like when you decide you're going to be an artist, you can say anything. You can even say nothing by just painting the canvas black. But that makes a statement also. So I just happen to prefer the way to work as a message giver, but I always haven't been that way as a student and as a neophyte artist. I would just do whatever I wanted, but then the art itself sort of nudged me into different issues and different concerns that I had. When I was a younger artist, a young mother, my work was mostly about nature and my children. And then certain issues, certain political issues, such as the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., sort of like made me really more concerned in political issues. And it was also about the time of the civil rights movement and the women's movement. So those also became concerns of mine.
So in any way, do you think your art has become more valuable as you've addressed those big issues, or as you said, for an artist, the art can be valuable in many ways?
Well, it's valuable to me because I feel not compelled to express these issues, but I feel like I am doing a service not only to myself, but to anyone else who may not be aware of these issues. And I feel that I do it in a way that makes people really want to look at the work and try to understand or decipher what I'm trying to say.
How has being a black woman affected the choices you've made in art?
Well, I am a black woman. I'm also just a woman, also just a human being. So I don't really dwell on those issues. I grew up in Pasadena, California. There was some segregation, but that was not really like growing up in another state in the South. So I just don't really think about it.
Okay.
And actually, being a woman and being a black woman has sort of promoted my career because people would like to give a show about women artists or black artists or something like that. So I just accept that as what it is.
Okay.
Me, I'm just Betty.
One of the things that has stood out to you for a lot of people, certainly not every observer, is how you're able to make art out of things that some people might just throw away. And I wonder, is that something you think is unique to you? Did you learn that from someone else? Is it just something you felt inside?
Well, I've always been attracted to stuff. As a kid, I would collect things. If we would move into a new house, we'd have to go to the trash and see what treasures could be found. And as a child, my grandmother, who was originally from Louisiana, lived in Watts, California. And during my childhood, we would drive by the spot where Simon Rodia was building the Watts Towers. And that seemed really unique at the that this strange shape was coming up. I was a kid that always liked fairy tales and sort of mystery. Mm-hmm. And there was this man building this mysterious thing. And then as an adult, I recognized him as the Watts Towers. And I think at a very early age, I was just sort of impressed with how he made something out of broken dishes and things that he found and put them in cement and built the Watts Towers. Then, of course, later on as an adult, I saw the works of Joseph Cornell, a very fine artist who really was outstanding in assemblage art. And then I said, hey, I could do that. And that was just fun, to just find things and to give them a place or have them tell a story. It is not unique to me. There is a whole assemblage movement of very outstanding artists. Ed Keenhouse from California was one. He's deceased now, but he is one of these artists.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix talking with artist Betty Saar. She's opening her first solo show at an American museum in about 5 years at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA, later this week. And the exhibition is called Still Tickin'. Betty, I suppose the exhibition's name, Still Tickin', speaks for itself, but what deeper themes should we read from that?
Well, one of the pieces in the exhibition is called Still Tickin', and it was sort of a memorial piece that I did for Richard Saar, who I was married to. And my three daughters and I had an exhibition in Pasadena, and we each made a piece for it. And it's a piece about me, actually, when I was born, when I went to school, when I got married, when I had kids, when Dick died, and so forth. And it means, of course, this is my 90th revolution around the sun, and I'm still ticking.
Yeah. How has your art or your creativity changed as you've aged? Have you had certain periods of ups, downs? Has that been affected by life circumstances, by aging?
Well, it has been down if I have to do a lot of traveling, if I have to do a lot of other obligations and can't get into my studio to make art. But I'm the kind of a person, I never feel pressured about getting work together for a show. I just keep doing the work all the time, and then later on the curator will come and select the work to put into an exhibition. Now, it's always just been part of my lifestyle, which is easygoing.
You know, you've already been humble about your experience as a woman, as a black woman, but a lot of people at the age of 89 have accomplished a lot of things, certainly, but not many of them are public. They're not opening art exhibitions at this age. Is that significant to you? It's significant to those of us who are observers to it.
Well, it's significant to me that I'm almost 90, and then that I have a still very active life. I have lots of friends. I go lots of places. Art is what I do. It's just part of my art. It's part of my life. So
I'll often ask writers this question. You know, do they have a certain technique or a certain schedule they have? Do you have a certain schedule when you are at home? Is there a certain amount of time devoted to your art? Do you have to be inspired on a certain day? How does that work for you?
No, that has never worked for me. I guess because I was making art when I was still a young mother, and I had to wait until they went to school or things like that. I never really scheduled my time like that. I can sometimes go out. My studio is very close to my home. I just go downstairs, and there's my studio. I'm still in my PJs, and I start putting things together. And so it just happens when what turns me on is the material itself. The material starts to speak to me in a way that says, hey, take me and put me together with something else and I can be a piece of art.
Well, you make it sound so simple, and obviously it's not. So the word that keeps coming to mind for me, though, with all the experience you've had, is actually courage. And I wonder, do you feel courageous as an artist because you have sort of the guts, the willingness to stand out and be yourself?
I just have that as Betty Saar. Hmm. But thank you for that compliment.
I've been talking with artist Betty Saar. Her latest solo show at an American museum is opening at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA, later this week, and the exhibition is called Still Tickin'. Betty, thanks so much. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their assistance on the program, and thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear my conversations with Betty Saar, Jason Alexander, or Eileen Klein, or one of our previous programs, please go online to KJZZ.org later this afternoon, or download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. This is KJZZ FM Phoenix in HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Have a great afternoon.
KJZZ is supported by the College of St. Scholastica, offering a BA in social work program designed to meet the needs of working adults and beginning a Doctor of Nursing Practice program in May. CSS.edu/Arizona.